CityCast from Explore City.
In Jerusalem, spiritual worlds collide, crammed together as closely as the cobblestones on the ground. For Jews, Jerusalem is the most important holy city and home to the Wailing Wall, all that is left of their sacred temple. For Christians, it is where Jesus Christ was sentenced to death, where he walked the stations of the cross, the Via Dolorosa, on the route to his crucifixion, and where his remains were entombed before his resurrection and ascension into heaven. For Muslims, the Dome of the Rock, which sits atop the Temple Mount, is the place from which Prophet Muhammad was taken up to heaven on a celestial horse brought to him by the angel Gabriel. No matter your faith or lack thereof, stepping into that setting is spectacularly moving. The old city itself evoked something out of an Arabian Nights fairy tale. The narrow limestone alleyways, the children playing in the street, the merchants selling their wares from sheets on the ground or in little one-room shops with bare fluorescent bulbs dangling from the ceiling, the scent of grilled shawarma meat and cardamom permeating the air. It reminded me of Balad in Jeddah, though here men walked by in black hats alongside women in hijabs. You heard Arabic from every second person, and to get basic directions, we picked up a few Hebrew words. I couldn't really tell who was Muslim or Jewish or Christian or Arab or Israeli. One of the first stops we made outside Jerusalem was at Masada. In AD 66, some 900 Jews fleeing the Roman siege of Jerusalem had taken refuge at the fortress of Masada, built high up on a mountain overlooking the Dead Sea. When it became clear that their defenses would fail and the Roman army would soon capture them, rather than be taken as slaves, they elected, en masse, to commit suicide. Well known to both Christians and Jews in the West, it was a historic event I'd never studied in school. This was a perfect example of something that children growing up in my part of the Middle East, not so far from here, were not taught. And of course, there were equally famous historic events with which we were intimately familiar, but they wouldn't have been taught to children here. The very founding of my faith occurred when the angel Gabriel appeared to Muhammad, who had withdrawn to meditate in a cave on Mount Hira, 3 miles north of the city of Mecca. And the angel proclaimed, "Read. Read in the name of your Lord who created man of a blood clot. Read, and your Lord is most bountiful. He who taught by the pen taught man that which he knew not." Quran, Surah 96, verse 1 through 5. It was on this 21st day in the month of Ramadan that Islam came to be. Seeking knowledge, we are taught, is the message Muhammad was given. Yet there was much the two sides didn't know about each other. Our team walked through the Women's Empowerment Center, which was operating in a multi-story building, one of the stops we were contemplating for the First Lady. The young man and woman escorting us took us to the roof as part of the tour. I looked out over the city, and other than the bright blue sea, most everything I saw was dusty, arid, and brown, except off in the distance, where I noticed a patch of vibrant green. There were nice buildings and what appeared to be trees and grass. It looked like a desert oasis or a mirage. "What's that?" I asked. "That," our consul general said, "is an Israeli settlement." "But it's so green. I thought you said there was very little running water here." "That's right," he said. "There's limited running water here. The Israelis control the water, so 20 times more goes there than comes here." It was the first time I saw up close what it was like to live under the daily humiliation Palestinians had suffered for years. There it was, a better, easier life, staring right at them. It was our job to be diplomatic, but I was fighting to maintain a neutral expression in front of our hosts. In my chest, a flash of outrage. We walked back downstairs, and as we said goodbye to the children, I feared that in a few years, their smiles would disappear. Toward the end of the advance, our team gathered with our Israeli hosts for lunch at a casual outdoor restaurant on the outskirts of Tel Aviv. The head of the Israeli delegation, a senior official in the foreign ministry, invited me to sit next to him. And we dug into the hummus and hot pita bread that greeted us after we took our seats. All our business done, it was mostly a social meal. We chatted about our lives and families, our own origin stories, sitting there in that land where all our faiths intersected. As we ended the meal, sipping on fresh mint tea, the official leaned over to me. "You know, we really like this American delegation," he said, "but you are our favorite because you are the most like us." Thunderbolt moment. Growing up in Saudi Arabia, in the heart of the Islamic world, I might have thought that there was no more other than an Israeli. We were raised on opposite sides of a vast divide, and that difference was supposed to instill mistrust. I did and always will feel an affinity, an alliance with my Palestinian brothers and sisters. Yet in that very moment, I knew he was right. Compared to most of my American colleagues, I did look more like them. I spoke more like them. I had a cultural connection with them. Intellectually, I knew that we worshiped the same God. Perhaps most revealing to me was that I felt very much at home. So what did that mean exactly? If we are so alike, then what would it take for us to stop killing one another?
They said there was something about Huma, and I tried to find out what. Well, something happens only in the first few seconds after you meet her. You sort of fall in love. Now, this immediacy of attraction thing is not for all the typical reasons, of which admittedly there are many, and it has nothing to do with perceived values like innate goodness, inner light, or such other syrup. Well, I'm putting it down to some I can't tell what it is, X factor if you like, and I'm moving on. My guest today is Huma Abedin. She is Hillary Clinton's chief of staff. Huma was deputy chief of staff when Hillary Clinton was secretary of state, and at present I'm assuming that her role is even more central. Huma has worked with Hillary Clinton in this job for over 25 years. Now, it isn't an easy job. I imagine that it would take not only a tough internal spirit and a strong work ethic, of course, but it would require something more deeply intellectual to be able to comprehend the scope and the meaning of such a job and then do it well. I imagine it was not the simplest thing for Huma Abedin to have lived in the Venn diagram overlap of being both an American and a Muslim whilst living in the penumbra of the Clintons and the White House. This, more than anything, summarizes the ethic, the plurality, the duality, if you like, of her book, Both And, a book that I will discuss with her today. Both And is a 500-page memoir of Huma's life till date. It has her childhood, her parents, her growing up years in Saudi, and then in the US, of course, and all her years of working for Hillary Clinton. In spite of its significance, I found that many of the reviews that I read, interviews that I heard with her about Both And, tended to be reductionist and didn't really focus on her as an author, a thinker, on her faith, and on her pivotal role as an assistant to one of the most powerful women in the world. I was puzzled because when I read Both And, I discovered through it a writer, a polyglot, a diplomat, and a sponge to knowledge. With Both And, Huma Abedin steps out from stage left right into her own spotlight and maybe a career in politics or diplomacy. Well, I'm privileged to be able to ask her that and other questions today. Huma Abedin, welcome to the Literary City.
Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
As am I. Okay, let's go. Tell me about your first day of work at the White House. What was it like walking in?
You know, it's one of the things I think about often, because people have asked me in the past year if I would consider going back to government, if I've aspired to work in the White House again or work in politics again. And I always say that that very first time that you approach that building, you know, for those of us who've been lucky enough to go into the White House and walk through those wrought iron gates and walk down the driveway and then down the red carpet and then up the marble staircase, there is a majesty and a power to that feeling of possibility, of hope, and to me, as living as an American overseas, I mean, I grew up in diaspora. The sense of the pride in being an American and the possibility, it was goosebumpy. Every day you'd get up and say, I can't believe I'm here.
I can imagine. Now, the first astronauts said that when they looked down on Earth from space, they realized the trivial nature of human problems. Now, I imagine such would be the case looking at the world from the high perch of the White House.
It felt, I think, because we traveled so much and we were, you know, in so many different countries and so many different cities around even this country in the United States, you felt like you were with people and among people very often. And so, yes, I think you end up being in a bubble. I mean, there is something to be said about, you know, riding in a motorcade and going past red lights and flying on Air Force One and, you know, traveling with hundreds of people. We certainly did all those things, you know, as a staff person in the White House. But I think perhaps it was also working for the Clintons. They were very interested in people and knew that, you know, the way to communicate really was to have those kinds of interactions. So we did a little bit of everything, but a lot of it was, you know, all of it really was about the American people.
Right. And about the people of the world, I guess. Now, traveling with Hillary Clinton, every conversation would have been fraught with history. Now, did you feel that you had to learn about the histories of the different countries that you were visiting?
So some part of it, I walked with a lot of confidence. We'd land in the Middle East and I would know the history and I would know about the royal family, or I could give my colleagues who didn't know as much about that part of the world, certainly the Arab world, the Muslim world, South Asia, I felt very empowered, you know, especially as a 21-year-old to know all these things that I thought other people didn't know. But on the other hand, you carried the weight of history on your shoulder. You know, it's how you interacted with the world. It's how you dressed. And, you know, you do. And our people, sort of senior colleagues would say to us all the time, remember, you are representing the president, the first lady in the White House. You have to remember the code of conduct is very important. And I took that very seriously.
Right. And your own international upbringing would have helped. Indian father, Pakistani mother. Do you have relatives in both countries?
I do. I have family both in India and in Pakistan. And some of my father's family did eventually. You know, my father chose to stay in India before he came to the United States. A lot of his relatives stayed in India, but some members of his family eventually came to Pakistan. But my mother's side, I actually think it was similar. I think that some members of my mother's family did stay in. It says both. They both have family in both places. Mm. Yeah.
The partition wasn't great, but so many interesting interwoven stories, right?
That's one of the reasons I wrote about the partition. I think a lot of people didn't understand the history, didn't understand, you know, the reason behind the partition and the impact that it had on, you know, millions and millions of people that we're still, you know, dealing with today. Yeah.
Mm. Stories of great horror, but also great spirit.
Yeah.
And your father was a man of such spirit, wasn't he? Now, there's this poignant line on page 6. My father was told he was dying, so he went out and lived.
It is one of the first lines when I sat to write the book. It's one of the first lines I actually sat to write. I mean, this notion of, you know, how you get up and move on with your life when you deal with or you're given bad news or you deal with something challenging. And for my father, I mean, that is one of the things that does keep me going and has kept me going through some very challenging moments in my own life. I mean, he was younger than me when he was essentially diagnosed with, back in the 70s, what was considered, you know, terminal. You had kidneys failing, and you focus on end of life care. Hmm. And he took that and went on an adventure. We, you know, moved to another country. We traveled the world. He started a thought institute. He started a foundation. I mean, he was constantly doing, and you know, went on, had four children, and was engaged with us, and you know, would listen to our poetry and encourage us to read and write and, you know, be creative. And my parents always said, you can do anything you want to do as long as you're educated. As you can see, that one of the themes and the through lines of this book is the importance of being educated and getting an education.
Yes. Right.
And so, all of that has been a wonderful kind of reminder of the privilege one has if you can walk in this world as a healthy person, because I am the child of somebody who is not. And I think some of that has stayed with me. Mm.
I know what that feels like. Now, you are the daughter of professors.
Yes.
Usually, one of two things happens in such a case. Either you hate it or you embrace learning forever. Now, the second one, right?
That's exactly right. No, I'm definitely one of those people who's excited about learning something new every day. And it's one of the reasons, you know, I was speaking at Columbia University last night with students about my book. And one of the questions I was asked was, how did you stay so long, you know, in one, you know, working in one, you know, with one person, one profession? I said, I always told myself the moment I woke up, the day I woke up, I didn't want to go to work or didn't feel like I was learning something or being challenged, was the day that I would give my notice.
But that day hasn't come. You're still at it.
No, not yet. I'm still at it. Very much still at it. Yes, absolutely.
That's great. Speaking of reading, at one point you mentioned the book, Twilight in Delhi, Ahmed Ali.
Yes.
Your father's cousin. It's one of my favorite books. And I was very chuffed to find out that I was going to be speaking to Ahmed Ali's niece.
Well, it's stunning, and you would appreciate it, the fact that, you know, my father is very humble. He didn't, you know, he was not somebody who bragged. He was not somebody who said, I know this person, I know that person. And what the gift of that experience was that I just found, you know, I was taking a South Asian literature course at university. I was reading many other books, but there was something about the story and the way he wrote it that I felt this deep connection to. I felt like it was actually a magical in some ways kind of, and I just found all of it kind of, you know, intoxicating in a way. So the surprise of telling my mother, and I decided to write my senior thesis about Twilight in Delhi and Ahmed Ali.
Cool.
And when I call my mother, she says he's our relative. And not only is he a relative, he was you would understand this. My father proposed to my mother. Ahmed Ali was one of the family members that went to my mother's parents to take the proposal and said, if you think anything of me, just know that Zain is a better man, referring to my father. And it was pretty, you know, mm-hmm. pretty amazing.
That's a great story. Your family moved to the U.S. and assimilated, but retained its faith and identity as Muslims. Was that challenging?
It wasn't sort of a label for me. It was just, you know, as my father always said, you're an American and you're a Muslim. And, you know, and I think my parents did that on purpose because they didn't want us to carry the burden of having to pick. You know, we loved both countries equally. Going to India, I felt like I was at home. Going to Pakistan, I felt like I was at home. I didn't see that, you know, sort of that difference. But they knew that carrying that and picking was going to be difficult. But to be Muslim is just a way of life. And so that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, was just kind of sharing, you know, our faith practices and what we did. And in fact, I've had lots of Muslim people stop me on the street or come to me at events and say, I appreciate that you write the story about being Muslim, not defensively,
right.
Not this is why, it's like, this is just my life, you know, this is just what we did.
Right. And you do speak of people who get conflicted with religion. You talk about that Quran teacher who was flagellating herself because a man saw her.
Yes. Oh, I'm so glad you brought that up. Yeah.
And that happened to you when you were a child and you wrote that you understood the reason for her reaction, but not the intensity, which seemed somewhat out of proportion. And you explain how that is in conflict with the hadith, which says that actions are but by intention.
Mm. So this idea of anything extreme, you know, to grow up in a household where moderation and discipline is good. I, you know, to the idea of sitting there as an 8-year-old, I must have been 8, 9 years old, and this woman who clearly by accident is seen by a man, and I understand why she covered her hair. I mean, I obviously understand why some, you know, women choose to do that and some women are forced to do that. I didn't understand why it was her fault.
You know, for all that, your descriptions of your years growing up and coming of age, and I suspect in Saudi Arabia, were joyous. And equally joyous about your descriptions of having of going back to Saudi Arabia as part of the United States team and choosing not to cover your head. There's a nice photograph of you coming out of the plane without the hijab.
Yes.
You know, I really like that description of that lunch that you had with the king.
Yeah.
It was so funny. There's so much of funny in your book.
Yeah. Oh, I appreciate that. We did. You know, I do write about the funny stories about losing Hillary's clothes or the, enjoying food and eating pizza copiously, staying out late, meeting my friends. I mean, there was this, you know, yes, there's the mission, there's the work, there's the effort, but we all liked each other. We all genuinely enjoyed what we were doing. And it was a wonderful, it was a wonderful journey, truly a wonderful journey.
In that lunch in Saudi Arabia, you mentioned how the guy that introduced you to King Abdullah introduced you as a girl who grew up in Saudi Arabia as a Bint al-Balad.
Bint al-Balad, yes.
But you're more of a Bint al-Alam, aren't you?
I love that, yes. I do feel like I'm more Bint al-Alam. I agree with you. I mean, I feel, I think so much of it has to do with one's self-worth and self-confidence and, esteem, because you have to be comfortable in your skin, your own skin, to go anywhere else and feel like you belong. And I really do. I mean, I really do feel like when I go to India that I am home, or Pakistan, or really any part of the Middle East, that I just fit in and I don't have a problem and I can relate to a certain food or language. And I think that's a great gift that I have. And I feel obviously very much at home in America. I am an American, you know, being in it's an East-West sort of meld, has worked out. I mean, I wish more people were, you know, able to kind of be raised that way, but that is a state of being.
And that sets us up very nicely to discuss the title of your book, Both And. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're both a Muslim and an American. You're both an American and a South Asian. This duality that I mentioned earlier. So was that the inspiration for your title?
In part, it was. You know, and yeah, the duality 100%, but also this notion of I believe that we are increasingly living in an either or world, that you can be this or that, you can't be either things. And that is, I'm unwilling to let go of the both and world, where there's a possibility that you can be two different things. You can be a working professional and a mother. Not that any of these things are easy. And the truth is often, you know, it's gray and it's complicated and it's messy, and, you know, whether it's politics or your personal life. And so for me, I approached the way that the book was, in that the way the book kind of came into being when I wrote it all down, it was actually the title was my editor's idea.
Cool.
But this idea that you don't have to be defined in a box, mm-hmm. that it can be a much more vivid, full picture of how to walk in the world. And I think that's the only, I think that's the best way to be, in my opinion, obviously.
And then at one time, you were called both a terrorist and a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, weren't you?
Yes, yes.
And I don't have to ask you how you felt.
It was so shocking. I mean, and that's why I chose to write about it. I mean, this idea that, and this is back in 2012, when fake news really was, not that, you know, fake news hasn't existed before, but really was sort of taking off. In fact, a friend of mine said, you know, you were actually the appetizer. I mean, testing out this idea of making, because again, what this did was made me the other, right? It's like, oh, she's not an American patriot. She's actually that, you know, Muslim, you know, mysterious woman who's whispering into Hillary Clinton's ears. And, you know, that's why I share the story in the book of going to Egypt in 2012 and Hillary having a meeting as Secretary of State with some Christian leaders, and they saying directly to her, you know, we are not sure that we trust your government because of your when I because of, you know, your aid, and she points me out and she has me speak to these this gentleman after the meeting, and he says, but they say that, you know, you don't. And it was all made up. I mean, these are fictional videos made up about my parents, you know, put on the internet by an extreme right wing, you know, group. And these things stayed, making an Arab, making somebody who's Muslim a scary other. And it worked. I mean, it's certainly, you know, I think they've tried it with Barack Obama when he ran in 2008. They kept labeling him a Muslim. Then they did it with me in 2012. And it was deeply, deeply painful. It was very, and that's why when John McCain, who is the Republican senator from Arizona, war hero, goes to the floor of the Senate to defend my name and basically say this is an upstanding American, and then President Obama does the exact same thing.
Yes, I recall.
At the White House. But it was actually wasn't even about me. It was about standing up for the principles and values that this country is built upon. And it was very distressing, I have to say. But one of the reasons I chose to write about it, because I think it's important to, you know, clear the air and put the facts out there.
Totally understandable. Let's talk about your job of 25 years now. You called working for Hillary Clinton as a club with a lifetime membership. And you explained that much of your job was following gut instincts and having good judgment.
Yes.
And did good judgment include fishing Hillary's suit out of the East River?
It did. You know, it's why I share the stories. You know, I speak to a lot of young people at universities especially, and they'll always say to me, how did you know you were going to be successful? How did you know it was going to be okay? And I always tell them, I didn't know. You know, all I knew is that I was prepared to outwork everybody else, and I was willing to show up and do the job. And, you know, one story I never get to tell is how I got the job traveling with Hillary. As I walked in, I was the youngest, least qualified person. And the woman who interviewed me said, why do you want this job? I said, I'm committed to the cause, and I want, you know, our Hillary Clinton to be successful. And she says, well, you got the job answering that first question, because it is about the mission. You have to put the mission in front of yourself. But when you are in, you know, the environment in the Clinton White House was the kind of sink or swim attitude. They threw you into something and they could, you know, you either sank or you swam. And I managed to swim. It's the first story I tell is traveling with Hillary and losing, you know, not knowing there are multiple helicopters, and the helicopter lands and then takes off and the prop wash throws the water. And you have two choices, either freak out or fix it. And I always did manage to figure out how to fix it. Like when she went on stage and didn't have her speech. And I said to her, I got it, and fixed the problem. And I think that's something I learned I was good at. I could figure out how to do. And I've managed to successfully do it for a while now.
There's an old saying that you can take the suit out of the East River, but...
Well, they were staying at the Waldorf Astoria, as presidents and first ladies used to stay at the time. And we figured out the dry cleaners just, you know, did a very quick turnaround. She went on stage 12 hours later. She had no idea. We didn't tell her that story for years. She didn't know that story for years. She had no idea.
That's no funny. Well, just as well you didn't tell her. You know, I know the East River. I don't know how I would have felt about knowing that night.
I know. Yes,
was right. Floating.
That's right. Yes. You may have never worn it again.
I suspect not. You know, one of the things about your job is that you have to be fairly stoic and available and at hand at all points in time, which means that people in your job would have to have what they call a stockbroker's bladder. Except once.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Yes, yes. But, you know, but this story, I shared this story, which, you know, it's funny. There was a disagreement about whether it should be in the book or not. And a couple of the men who read the early version of the book said, oh, this is too much information. But the point, I mean, that story really is about Hillary. I mean, this idea that, you know, this is when she was Secretary of State. She slipped and fell, hurt her elbow. We take her to a hospital. Her elbow needs to be x-rayed. It's clearly very badly damaged. And so I'm standing there. She takes off her jacket to have it x-rayed. I could see just from how swollen and disjointed it was. And I passed out. Just seeing that grotesque arm. I passed out and I peed in my pants.
Oh, no.
And I did not know that. I didn't even realize it. The next thing I know, I open my eyes. I'm sitting. Her doctor is not with her. She's standing. She's sitting at the x-ray table with her arm out extended. And she says, get her some juice, get her some crackers. And I said, what's going on? And it turned out I had fainted and I had wet myself and I'd never done it before. I thankfully have never done it since. But to me, that was such a story. And here she was, you know, so badly injured herself and worried about, you know, her staff person who doesn't like hospitals. And, you know, just it's really an extraordinary story about yes. Hillary, I think, but also a funny one.
Definitely. Yes. That story from the male perspective, TMI. But it's a good thing that you included that story. It's funny.
Yeah. It's a good one.
So did you always want to be a writer?
What? No, I mean, I loved writing when I was younger, when I was a little girl, and I would write poetry and I would write a lot of short stories, a lot of fictional short stories that were, I mean, honestly, it was quite terrible. I mean, there were these very dramatic, poetry was horrible,
oh. But
I was very proud of my work and my parents would encourage me and guests would come and I would say, do you want to hear my new poem? Mm-hmm. And I would stand up and I would recite the poem. My father always believed I was going to be a writer, I think. And he would bring books back from his trips. And I share the story of when I was 10, he brought back Silas Marner by George Eliot. And I looked at the back and I said, you know, the material was above my head. And I said to my father, why did this woman, Marianne Evans, use the name George Eliot? And he said, well, in the Victorian era, women weren't taken seriously as writers. But don't worry, when you grow up, you'll write your own story and you'll use your own name. And so I think he always believed that I was a good writer and that this was a path for me. And he was right. The thing that really surprised me, that I had many surprises in the experience of writing the book and on the book tour. What surprised me the most is how much I loved writing it.
Did Hillary Clinton read the manuscript?
She did. She did. She was one of the first people to read it. And you know, she would write notes in the margins and saying, I don't remember, this story is very funny or, you know. But she was wonderful. I mean, she basically said, you write whatever it is you want to write and I'm going to support you. And she was... as she has been throughout, she's been a mentor, a friend, a guide, but a very, very supportive person in my life. I'm lucky to have her.
I can see that. Yes. Yeah. Now, you've described yourself as the invisible body that followed HRC, Hillary Rodham Clinton. And now you're stepping into the sun. Into what?
You know, you are asking me this question at a very interesting time.
Oh, good.
The short answer, this is in that, you know, when I first sat down to write the book, actually the preface, there was a prologue and it was called The Cliff.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd written it at a very low moment in my life. And the whole, you know, the theory behind The Cliff was here I am standing on the precipice of a cliff and I was about to jump. And all I could imagine was how painful it was going to be, how hard and how difficult and what it would feel like to hit the bottom. And I send it to my agent and my literary agent. My agent says, listen, just write the story.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of all of this, like, this is going to be horrible and painful. Just tell us your story. Just tell us your story. Because I do think I spent a lot of my life too paralyzed, you know, in decision or anger or fear. Should I do this? Should I do that? I think we're constantly, especially as women, you know, not sure about choices we make in our lives. And now I'm doing all kinds of things that I would have never, you know, chosen to have, you know, done before.
One of the meanings of your name, Huma, am I saying it right?
Yes, you are.
Is bird of paradise, the phoenix. So does the rising from the ashes include a political career?
I don't see it. I don't see a path. You know, I've lived that life. I've worked for a politician. I was married to a politician. I know exactly what it takes to be in that game. And to be in that profession and the sacrifices and the effort. I still think there's nothing like public service. It's extraordinary. And maybe there'll be an opportunity, but I don't see it.
Okay. Well, for our listeners, there's a link in the podcast description to where you can buy a copy of both. And it's 500 pages long and it's a breezy, wonderful read. Among other things, it's a tale about faith, about family, and about forgiveness for sure. Huma, you're 47 and your memoir's 500 pages long. 500 pages and you're only 47.
I'm so glad you said only 47. When you said you're 47, I thought you meant, okay, you're at the, you know, you're on the back end now.
No,
yes.
Not at all. Not from my perspective. Well, now your book is the TV series, Frida Pinto playing you. Looking forward to it?
Gosh, I met her for the first time this summer and I thought, you know, just standing next to her, I thought, oh my goodness, I'm so lucky. I mean, she's just extraordinary. I mean, beautiful, but more than that, her presence and her mind. I'm really excited.
As you should be. Now, you can't write one book and stop. So, another book?
Oh, wow. Well, maybe. You never know. That would be something I think it would be really interesting to do as another book. We'll see.
I look forward to it.
You can have me back on the podcast.
Yes.
And I would be able to come back on the literary podcast.
Oh, I'd love that. But, you know, I'd like to have you back on the show even when the book transitions into the TV series.
That would be wonderful. Yeah.
Well, that was such an enjoyable conversation. Huma Abedin, thank you so much for being my guest today on The Literary City.
Thank you for having me. I really, really, what a thoughtful, interesting, different conversation. So thank you.
My privilege entirely. And that was the wonderfully resourceful and talented and beautiful Huma Abedin, author of Both And. And I'll be back with What's That Word, that fun segment where we look at words and phrases that we use all the time but never stop to think about. In a minute, or less, depending in which country you are right now. And I'm back. It's What's That Word, and she is my co-host.
Hello. My name is Pranithi, but you can call me P. That's P with an A, not another E.
And hello to you, P with an A. And today, what do you see with another E?
Oh, so we're being all poetic today.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that was a great interview with Huma Abedin.
Thank you. I so enjoyed that.
Yeah, she seems so savvy.
True, she is savvy. And you know, the word I'd also pick is incisive. She draws from a rather deep well, doesn't she?
Yes, that's true. I got that too. Mm. But I have a couple of questions about the interview.
Go.
What was that Arabic bit that amused the two of you so much?
Oh, that. Well, when she was being introduced to King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, the guy introducing her referred to her as a Bint al-Balad, which means daughter of the country, because she spent her growing years in Saudi, right?
Right.
And I asked if she wasn't really a Bint al-Alam, a daughter of the world.
Yeah, that is so true about her. Bint al-Alam. Did I say that right?
No. Well, to pronounce it correctly, as you say Alam, you jab your forefinger into the soft tissue in your throat so that the first vowel splits properly.
No, thanks. Call me crazy, but I prefer my throat unjabbed.
Well, that's your loss entirely.
Okay, on to my second question.
Mm-hmm.
In your monologue,
right.
Why did you call the rest of the media reductionist?
Well, I was not happy with the way they handled their questions about her book, but I didn't mean that as a criticism.
Yeah, sure.
No, really. Well, it's actually their choice of angle. It's their choice. But, I mean, after I read the book, I became very interested in Huma's intellectual bandwidth. But the other media, even TV interviewers like Colbert, Seth Meyers, and, well, almost everyone except Noah, I must say, made their interviews about everyone other than Huma, like Hillary Clinton or Anthony Weiner and, you know, all the other subjects and so on and on and on.
Yeah, actually, you're so right about that. Mm. But tell me about the book reviewers. What did they say?
Yeah, but even my favorite paper of all time, you know, which is the New York Times, the book review I read had this sentence. Let me pull it up sec. Okay, here it is. Abedin herself does not fully come to life on the page until she actually meets Weiner. Mm. Now, I couldn't disagree more with that because, you know, I thought the book was zinging before she wrote about her ex with his cell phone and email escapades.
Yeah, I see what you mean by reductionist.
Yeah, I know. I mean, she has so much going for her in terms of all the stuff that she has done in so many parts of the world with so many heads of state. And, you know, they focus on her marital problems. Now, it's not that she didn't suffer a very traumatic time. And it's hard to suffer that when you are in the public eye and could cause harm to your boss, for instance. But still, I cannot see why Colbert, another person I admire and watch every day, didn't ask her any questions about foreign policy or worldview and so on. She was there, wasn't she?
Yeah, you're right. Well, clickbait sells books.
Hey, I did some of that too. The suit in the East River, her stealing the attention away from Hillary Clinton in the hospital ER. My clickbait karma is fulfilled.
Clickbait karma. What a great book title that'll be.
Isn't it? Well, actually, I must say that in 1979, Geeta Mehta, an author from New York, did write a book called Karma Cola. It was all about the hippie generation descending on India in the 60s and 70s.
What fun.
Fun-ish. I don't think the book quite found its feet. But anyway, much of what is considered a populist is what our previous guest, Jerry Pinto, called pablum. And that is a form of reductionism.
Yes, I remember Jerry Pinto did use that word, pablum.
Well, there you go. Well, all right, P with an A, what's that word?
Pablum.
Great, let's do that word. All right, what do you know of its meaning?
To be honest, I didn't know anything of that word. But I looked it up after Jerry used it, and I found it's a brand name for baby food. And I'm guessing old people too, right? Like baby formula.
Yep, that's right.
And so I figured that any writing that's pappy, you know, like pasty baby formula, is called pablum. Is that right?
Yes, spot on.
Okay. So on to the etymology now, please.
Sure. Okay, so pablum. You know, let me say it the way I know that word, pabulum. It was pabulum in Latin, and the Brits still say it that way. And pablum is more American usage. And it's a brand name, as you said. So because it's a brand name, it's become better known. So pablum is the more used form than pabulum.
Cool.
So in Latin, pabulum means fodder. And from there, nourishment. You see what I mean?
So which is why baby formula is called pablum.
Yeah. So the other Latin synonyms for pabulum would be alimentum, victus, and panis.
Alimentum? Ew.
Okay. Let's focus on panis. Now, the root of everything food in English etymology is the syllable pa, P-A. And that is from the P-I-E.
That's not a pun, is it?
What? Oh, pie. The root of food is pie. I get it. No. P-I-E, Proto-Indo-European root.
Oops, sorry.
So from pa come several words that we understand well. So panis is bread. And from there, panini, also pasta, and pasture for animals.
That is cool.
And also pastry and pantry, also pa words, pastry, pantry, and pasta, same thing.
Wow, that's interesting. But wait, did you say pastor, like a priest?
Completely, yes. Pastor means shepherd, you know, flock. He cares for the pasture, and his words are fodder for his flock, you see?
And now I get pablum.
Yes, you're brimming with faith. But yes, pablum or pabulum in prose refers to anything bland, you know, like the baby food. So when you have something that's insubstantial or so on, you call it pablum. And by the way, in 1970, the U.S. Vice President, then Vice President Spiro Agnew, used the word pablum to mean squishy or inconsequential political prose.
Yeah, I totally get it. But wait, I have a last question. You said a synonym for pabulum was victus.
Yeah, what about it?
So is that the origin of the word victuals?
Yes, it is. As a matter of fact, V-I-C-T-U-A-L-S, pronounced victuals, of course.
Of course. All right, so tonight I will make my datum get me some victuals. He feeds me pablum usually.
That sounds like a terrible date. Well, okay, have fun.
Bye.
And that is our show. I'd like to thank my guest, Huma Abedin, and my co-host, Pranathi P. with an A, Madhav. And you for being here and for listening. Now, before you go, hit that subscribe button. Make sure you never miss an episode of The Literary City. Have a great week. See you again next Wednesday.